The Fulton State game area somehow manages to be both a very large area and, at the same time, also a very small one. It has vast, inaccessible expanses of swamp and woodland that you can get lost in if you're not careful. But during hunting season, well, the place can start to feel very small indeed.
We call that the pumpkin patch. The year before, we had actually hunted here and actually it was the other side of the road here. Mm-hmm. And when daylight hit, all you could see was along, here's the field. Mm-hmm. Man, and we're all orange.
The pumpkin patch.
Yes, and everybody, if a deer, and it actually did, ma'am, a deer come out, and a doe, and it ran right out here, and she was safe as all could be, because we would all shot at each other. Nobody could shoot because everybody was facing each other.
On Saturday, November 17th, 1990, on the day that Jim Bennett and Doug Estes were killed, the pumpkin patch was crawling with hunters. And while working on this case, I've tried to track down as many of them as I can find, tried to pinpoint where they were and when, and what they may have seen or not seen, and what they drove to get there. Basically, I've tried to reconstruct, as much as I can, the movements of all the people and vehicles going in and out of the game area and surrounding streets on a single afternoon 30 years ago.
My thought was probably back in here.
So past the field?
Yeah.
It's a pinch point here. It's so swampy in there, you can't. There's like bogs and quicksands like where you could just go down.
Y'all were like on Y Avenue, right?
Yeah.
Only thing I can remember is walking in from a parking lot and swamp was over here. And
we were right here because this right here is, I know this field right here because I actually shot a deer right here before.
At times, trying to reconstruct all this almost feels like some kind of Sudoku puzzle. If Hunter X was at this land by himself at time one, then Hunter Y could not have been at this point until time two. And therefore, the red Chevy truck could not have been in parking lot A at that time, and we can remove it from the list of possible vehicles in the parking lot. There's enough there anyway to give you the illusion that if you can just work through all these bits of info from the case file and interviews, well, eventually, maybe you can make it all snap together in a coherent, cohesive way. And sometimes that does happen. Sometimes, the reports from different hunters who were out there match up in tidy, satisfying ways. Take, for instance, a tip that was called in 2 days after the murders by a man named Don. He said that on the 17th, he'd been out hunting in the game area with his pistol when he'd encountered a man who had parked his truck deep within the woods, at a place that would take quite a bit of maneuvering to get to. To Don, it looked like someone had been trying to hide the truck there. The driver was not far away, and he was, according to Don, scraggly and suspicious-looking. He was also wearing army fatigues, but no orange, and had a 12-gauge shotgun with him. Don talked to the man, who'd given some odd answers, but then when Don had turned around for a moment, the man had snuck away and driven his truck off. The location where Don had seen this man was not particularly close to the site of the murders, but still, it's something worth checking out. But there was no real way of following up on Don's tip about the scraggly man until 2 months later when a second tip, this one anonymous, got called in. This tip identified a guy named Jake as someone who was supposedly crazy and violent and had been hunting out there in the game area on the day of the murders. So Detective Racema went to talk to Jake, and Jake told him a story about an encounter he'd had in the game area with a clean-cut looking guy carrying a pistol. Jake had thought the clean-cut looking man might have been a cop, and since Jake was an ex-con and shouldn't have been out there hunting in the first place, he decided to sneak away and go hunt somewhere else. So case closed, mystery resolved, on to the next. Not all the questions in this case, though, have such tidy answers. Not all the people who were seen out of the Fulton game area that day were identified, including several people who were at or very near the crime scene itself. People that you might have expected would have come forward, say they'd been there, but who never did. When I first started looking into this case, I couldn't shake the feeling that if we could just somehow find out who these unknown people were and why they were there that day, well, maybe we'd find the answers to what happened to Jim Bennett and Doug Estes. And now, after months of investigation, I still feel that way. In fact, I'm now convinced of it. And welcome to the Undisclosed Podcast. My name is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I'm here with my colleague Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Robbie is currently traveling, but she'll be back next week. This is episode 3 of our series on the case of Jeff Titus out of Kalamazoo County, Michigan. Jeff Titus was convicted in 2002 for a murder of two hunters in the Fulton State game area that happened in 1990.
The main block of the Fulton game area is bounded by X Avenue to the north and Y Avenue to the south, and by 44th Street to the west and 46th Street to the east. Because Bear Creek runs through the middle of the game area, though, the two sides are effectively split from one another. The east half is expansive, with marsh and woods and several fields that are maintained as habitat for the species that prefer the fields to the woodlands. This is the part of the game area that people have told me about getting lost in. It's accessible from at least 4 different parking areas, though hunters can also choose just to park on the side of the road and walk in, which they often do. In comparison, the east side of the game area is smaller, much smaller. It's a sliver of land that's roughly 6 times longer than it is wide, with only a single parking area at its very northern tip, off X Avenue.
There's a strip down through here.
You kind of get like channeled in, like it's...
Yeah, it goes to a point back there where the water just stops. You can't go on farther.
A hunter who goes into the east side of the Fulton game area is entering a narrow chute of public land, bound to the west by the physical barrier of the swamps of Bear Creek, and bound to the east by the legal barrier of private property. And much of that area isn't even forested. Its northern half is taken up by a large empty field, and while the southern half is all woodlands, it's even narrower there. At its narrowest, from east to west, it's only about 120 yards wide, or the length of a football field. And the distance from the southern edge of the Fulton game area field down to the end there, where the swamp makes things impassable, is a little over 500 yards. So imagine an area about a size of 10 football fields laid out lengthwise, stacked on top of another. That sounds like a large area to you, it feels a lot smaller once you're back there. And while the trees do block the visibility some, you'll still be able to see everything going on in the area around you. Which would mean, for instance, that if you're standing back in that patch of woods, it would be nearly impossible for someone to pass through this strip without you noticing they're there. Though, if you were hiding in a blind, someone might be able to pass through without them noticing you.
You don't know, there's a lot of people out there hunting. That's what it's for. So you just don't know who's territorial and who's got their blind set up and thinks, I want you out of here, because I'm hunting here. You could come up and sit 30 yards away from somebody and not even know they're there. But they see you come, and they're going, get out, you're in my line of fire. Get, move, I don't want you in here. So you just don't know exactly where they're headed with this stuff.
It was here in this strip of woodland on the east bank of Bear Creek, just south of the game area's large field, that Jim Bennett and Doug Estes were shot. There were no eyewitnesses to the shooting, but lots of people heard the shots.
Let's start off with witnesses in this case who are not a mystery. The ones who we know were at the crime scene and who had good reasons for being there. There's Bobby Brown, of course. That's Doug Estes' 18-year-old stepson, who first found the bodies. And there's Mark Perry, Doug Estes' friend, who Bobby ran to for help. Both Mark and Bobby were at the crime scene, though Bobby was there only briefly before he left again. And then there's Ron Elwell. He lived in the log cabin adjacent to the game area, and Mark Perry had gone to him for help. Of everyone in and around the game area that day, Ron Elwell was perhaps the only person who already had an alibi, of sorts, from the very start. Because he was the one person that Bobby and Mark knew couldn't have been involved in the murders.
Yeah, because it seemed like I could see the cornfield from right where I was at. Because that's where I kept looking, because I could hear that hammering. And I figured whoever did it wasn't them. Because they're still hammering. They was doing that when we got there, I think. They were building an A-frame house or something.
the hammering you heard all day long.
Yeah. So I was thinking, what are they? Picked a bad time to do that. But really, deer don't pay attention to that.
After Bobby had shown him the bodies, Mark Perry had run to where he'd heard the sound of Ron Elwell's hammering and asked for help. And Ron Elwell had gone back with him to the crime scene. It was Ron Elwell's wife, Sandy, who made the only known 911 call in this case.
I called 911. Somebody else probably could have too, but I'm the one that called it when the man was screaming for help and Ron went that way.
Here's the strange thing, though. There actually isn't any record of a 911 call being made. At least, Kalamazoo County doesn't have any records of it. As best as I can figure out, when Sandy Elwell called 911, her call accidentally got routed to a different county altogether. And that's why the only response was from an ambulance that was run out of a local funeral home over in Calhoun County. Although I'm not even confident about that, because in the original police report, there's a note next to the name of two ambulance employees who'd arrived at the scene, and it just says, quote, employed by Spencer Ambulance Service and was driving by the scene just shortly after it happened when he was waved over. No statements were taken at this time. I'm not sure what the report means by waved over. Did the ambulance really just happen to be driving by when someone at the scene saw it and flagged it down? If so, who? Or maybe that police report got it wrong. Maybe Spencer Ambulance Service did get dispatched to the game area in response to Sandy Elwell's 911 call, and someone in the parking area saw them and directed them to where the two victims were. However way it happened, Spencer's ambulance did eventually get there. As did two other people that Sandy Elwell had called.
Yeah, then you called Clarence, didn't you?
Then I called the neighbor next door, who is my relative, to come down because Ron didn't come back, and he didn't come back, and it was starting to get dark, so him and his son came, and they shined the lights of their truck out that way so they would know which way to come back. And then they went up to where Ron was. Mm-hmm.
After a time, when Ron Elwell still hadn't returned from the woods, Sandy Elwell had called her relatives and neighbors, the Joneses, who lived next door to them by the game area. Clarence Jones and his son Todd, who was home from college that weekend, went into the woods to find Ron and joined him there at the crime scene, where he was waiting with Mark Perry. As Ron Elwell recalls now, other than the emergency responders, Clarence and Todd Jones were the only people out there in the area where the bodies were found.
The only ones that were back there, and I would have... It seemed like Clarence and Todd came back right about the same time the ambulance did, because I remember old Mr. Spencer coming back.
Even once the ambulance arrived, though, it was some time yet before the police got there.
I don't know if it was an hour, but it sure seemed like it.
It seemed like an hour.
It was dark before anybody else got back there.
In traumatic situations, it's not uncommon for people to have erratic and inaccurate memories about how much time has passed between events. But this long delay before the police finally got here at the game area, that's something that pretty much every witness who was there has described.
Parked in the street, and then, God, it took hours for the first cop to show up.
The police didn't get there for a very long time.
Oh, I know.
In fact, in this case, it was a matter of luck that the police had even gotten there before the bodies were removed from the scene. By chance, David Landrum, a fireman with the local fire department, had been out hunting in the game area that day. And when he saw the ambulance arrive at the parking area just off of X Avenue, he'd gone to figure out what had happened. And he's the one who eventually realized that although an ambulance had been dispatched to what looked to him to be a double homicide, for some reason, no one had bothered to tell the police about it yet. When we talked to David Landrum, he told us that the ambulance workers had been about to load up the bodies and carry them to the ambulance. And the only reason they hadn't is because he'd been there to stop them. He then went to a local house to call the police himself. But that didn't happen until 6:18 p.m. Once they did receive the call, the Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Office had responded quickly. One officer testified that he'd driven there well in excess of 120 miles per hour to get to the Fulton State game area. But by then, it was nearly pitch black out. And also by then, at least four unidentified people who were at or near the crime scene, under circumstances that could be fairly characterized as suspicious, were long gone. The first of the unknown and unidentified people at the crime scene is Mr. Orange Hat. Or, well, that's the name I've taken to calling him by, in my notes at least. Mr. Orange Hat is the man that Bobby Brown ran into in the woods almost immediately after he found the bodies. And when he ran into him, Bobby had pointed his shotgun straight at Mr. Orange Hat's face. He'd been worried this man might have been the killer. The man in the orange hat had been calm about it, though, and asked Bobby to take him back and show him where the bodies were. Bobby had done so, though looking back, the request now seems odd to him.
And he has the orange hat, blonde hair, glasses. Does he say anything to you at the scene? In one statement, I think you mentioned he says, don't touch anything, or...
Yeah, I think he did tell me that. I told him it was too late. I already touched everything.
When Bobby realized that the man wasn't going to be able to offer him any help, Bobby took off once more, heading for the parking lot where he and Mark Perry and his stepdad had originally driven in. Bobby doesn't know what happened to the man in the orange hat after that. He never saw him again. But Bobby wasn't the only one out there in that part of the game area to see an unknown person in the woods that day, at a place and time that, in hindsight, it seems suspicious.
Somebody did see somebody walking out. Couldn't identify him, but saw him walking out toward the parking lot after the shots were fired. That was Mark Perry, who was hunting to the west of the field where you enter into the wooded area where the gentlemen were shot. He's never been identified. We don't know who he is. Nobody's come up with any information. Nobody's volunteered the information.
No one has volunteered any information about this unknown hunter, but that could also be because out of all the unknown people of interest in this case, this is the one there's the least info about. Mark Perry was the third member of Doug Estes' hunting party, and he'd been hunting that day to the west of the field there, in a little sliver of woods between the field and the swamp. Mark Perry had heard two shots, the ones that he would later learn had killed his friend Doug and also a man he didn't know. And then, not long after that, maybe 15 or 20 minutes later, he'd seen a man in a bright orange coat walking out towards the parking area. At that time, Mark Perry hadn't known anything was wrong, or that this man could be in any way important. All he'd seen was a fleeting glimpse of a man in his 50s who was kind of portly and shortish, with noticeable white hair and beard. He had what Mark Perry described as a Kenny Rogers look about him.
Good possibility that's the killer there that just walked out after, just before dark and Bobby yelling and stuff.
There was absolutely nothing suspicious seeming about Kenny Rogers at the time that Mark Perry saw him, but it's the timing of his presence there that's troubling. Kenny Rogers could have been just another hunter out looking for deer, yeah, but where'd he come from? When Mark Perry saw him, he was already in the field, walking out, but if he'd been hunting anywhere in the woods south of the field, and it's hard to see where else he could have been coming from, well, he should have seen the two bodies lying there as he was walking out. So why hadn't he seen them? Or, if he did see them, why didn't he ever say anything about it? The next unidentified person is someone we've been calling Ditch Guy. And he was driving a vehicle that we've been calling Ditch Car. Because, as you may have guessed, Ditch Car and Ditch Guy were seen by witnesses after they were stuck in a ditch at an intersection next to the game area.
I'm Helen Knoffs. I live right across the street from the Fulton game area.
Helen Knoffs became a witness in this case when on the afternoon of November 17th, 1990, she got a call from a neighbor about a car that had run off the road. Although Helen didn't know the exact time she got the call about the car in the ditch, she thought it was around 5 p.m., maybe a little after.
My neighbor called me and said that a car had gone in the ditch down at the corner and they needed someone to pull them out of the ditch. And I came down here with my son to see if I could help or offer any assistance.
At the time, this whole incident hadn't seemed terribly important to Helen. But when she learned that two hunters had been shot and killed in the game area at around the same time the man had driven into the ditch, she realized it was possible the two events had been connected.
Yeah, the front of the car was like right in the middle of this corner. And I'm not sure, I don't think he hit that post, but it was close.
In Helen's interview with the Red Marble team, she's standing at the southeastern corner of the Fulton State game area. This is where 30 years ago, after receiving that call from her neighbor, she'd come down to find the car that had run off the road.
There was a car nose down in the ditch right here, and there was a man standing here, and he said he needed help getting the car out of the ditch. And I said, we should probably, I'll go home and call the police for you and get a wrecker. And he said, no, I don't need a the police. And I said, well, you'll need the police to have a police report for your insurance. And he said, oh no, my brother-in-law will fix the car. So I just need some help getting the car out of the ditch. And then about that time, a black truck pulled up to the stop sign, and the guy in the car asked, could he pull him out of the ditch? And he said he could. And so I got in my car and went home.
In 1990, when she talked to detectives about the ditch car, Helen said the man had explained to her it was his wife's car that he was driving, and that he had a brother, her brother-in-law, who could make the repairs needed for any damage that had been done.
He was seemed upset and was nervous. You know, you could be upset from putting your car in the ditch. He just seemed like he didn't want to mess with anything here, and he didn't want anybody around, and he was sweating.
In addition to how sweaty and agitated the ditch driver had been, he'd said something that Helen had found puzzling, even at the time. He told her that he'd gone off the road there at the intersection because he'd swerved to miss a deer.
Yes, he said that a deer ran across and he swerved to avoid it. And I don't know where the deer would have come from, because I've never seen a deer cross here, and I've lived here for a number of years.
Helen wasn't the only witness who contacted police about the ditch car. A woman named Bonnie Huffman also contacted the Kalamazoo Sheriff's Department and told them that in the afternoon of November 17, 1990, she'd been out hunting that evening on her parents' property. Her parents, the Burnworths, were actually Jeff Titus's neighbors. They lived opposite the road from him on 46th Street. And the spot that Bonnie said she'd been hunting that day was along the edge of the southern edge of the property, not far from the intersection of Y and 46th. It was Detective Worsima who went out to interview Bonnie Huffman about what she could remember about the ditch car.
Miss Huffman, in regard to the fact that somebody had sounded like to her, somebody went off the road by the sounds, not by the sight. She didn't see anything happen. The car, according to her, I think she thought it was heading southbound at a high rate of speed, came to the corner intersection, somehow lost control, probably trying to make a turn. When Miss Huffman was out in the corner property hunting, she heard other people stop by, offer help. The person who was in the ditch refused help.
To Bonnie Huffman, the weird thing about the guy in the ditch had been that she'd heard at least three people stop and try to offer the man help, but he'd refused all of them. He seemed not to want anyone near him. Bonnie told Detective Worsima that when the stuck motorist had turned down an offer of help from the third and last man that Bonnie heard stop by, she'd heard him tell the man in the ditch, "Okay, by the way, I'll call the law." And the man in the ditch had responded, "No, don't. I'll get out myself." This had struck Bonnie Huffman as suspicious, but that was as much info as she was able to offer. She'd never seen the car or the driver, she told Detective Worsima. She only overheard some of what had happened. But combined with a report from Helen Knopfs about Ditch Guy's demeanor and how he'd been profusely sweating and irritated, not wanting help, well, it seemed possible all this had been connected in some way to the murders at the game area.
Yeah. Yes. If you're skedaddling from a crime scene, such as a double homicide, and you lose control of your car trying to get out of the area, and you're stuck there, it would be a little irritating and upsetting.
Detective Worsima had gotten Helen Knopfs and her son to prepare a composite image of the ditch man, and in doing so, produced an image that Helen described as being 90% alike to the man she'd seen. Though the composite itself does not depict the most distinctive-looking individual, he's a white man in his 30s with a stocky build, maybe 5'10" in height. His face is broad and round and a little soft-looking, and he was wearing metal-rimmed glasses with large lenses and sort of an aviator style. Helen remembered he'd had some camo on, as if he'd been out hunting, and he was also wearing a blaze orange knit hat. Helen described the car as something close to a 1987 Dodge Shadow, but not exactly that. The car she'd seen had less trunk, and its windows had sloped more. It also had a blonde taillight that didn't wrap around the sides of the car, and also, one of the taillights had been busted out and fixed up with duct tape. As for its color, Helen thought the car had been black, but her son said the car had been a dark silver. Other witnesses who had driven by the car in the ditch had given similar descriptions as Helen and her son. They described it as something like a black or dark gray Chevy Monza. And the truck that had pulled the Monza-like car out of the ditch was also described as a Chevy, maybe black or tan or brown in color.
The truck driver, Good Samaritan, was never identified, never came forward. No information ever was developed on who that might have been. There was no information developed on who the car that went into the ditch might have been. Nor were we able to locate a vehicle fitting the description as described by Miss Knopfs, Mrs. Knopfs. Followed it up as far as we could. Again, went nowhere, dead end.
The detectives had posted flyers around the Fulton area that showed the composite image and the car that he'd been driving. They even took out an ad in the Kalamazoo Gazette, asking people to call them with any leads. And although quite a few people let the detectives know they too had seen the ditch car and the truck that had pulled the ditch car out, no one could name the driver of either vehicle.
In addition to the unidentified hunters who were in or around the crime scene, there were six hunters who were spoken to at the scene and identified in initial reports. Five of those had been in a group hunting together on the west side of the game area, and the sixth, a guy named Garth Snow, had been out by himself that day. Garth Snow was an important witness in this case because, aside from Bobby and Mark Perry, he's the only person who has been identified as having been there on the east side of Bear Creek at the time that Doug Estes and Jim Bennett were killed. He'd been in a strip of woods not too far from where Mark Perry must have been, and given how thin the trees are, it seems plausible, maybe even probable, that the two might have glimpsed one another in the hours they were hunting there. Which raises the question of whether Garth Snow could have been one of the unidentified hunters that Mark Perry or Bobby saw that day. It's something that Detective Worsema wondered as well.
It was a figure walking out. There was another individual out here, I believe, Garth Snow. That came up in the report. Timing-wise, it doesn't appear that was him walking out. He was interviewed extensively and found not to be involved.
Garth Snow told police that he'd driven to the Fulton game area in his Chevy van, and he'd parked off of X Avenue. When he arrived at the parking area, there had been only one car present, a blue Ford Taurus with a white top. Snow said that the Fulton game area had been a new place to him, and for that reason, he decided not to stray from the parking area too far. In fact, he'd barely ventured into the game area at all. Instead, he'd hunkered down at the far northwest edge of the field, just one or two trees deep. Around dusk, he'd headed back to his van, but when he got there, to the parking area, the white-topped blue Taurus was gone. In its place was Jim Bennett's blue Camaro and Mark Perry's green truck. After learning about the two hunters who'd been shot from Bobby Brown, Garth Snow hung around the parking area for a while, and when the ambulance got there, he led them back through the field towards the forest. But he never actually went into the crime scene, and all he ever saw was the victim's feet, somehow glimpsed through the woods from the field where he was standing. But that was the only time that he'd been back there through the field, Garth Snow said. Which means, if Garth Snow's description of where he was hunting that day is accurate, he'd never been walking up the field where Mark Perry had seen the unknown hunter walking out not long after the shots were fired. And that means that Garth Snow can't be Kenny Rogers. That leaves us with Mr. Orange Hat, the unknown man that Bobby had seen. From reading the case file, I'd managed to convince myself that this was the simple answer to the mystery of the man in the orange hat. He'd been Garth Snow all along. It was an easy answer to the problem, anyway. And Garth Snow had told police that he'd encountered Bobby after he'd gone back to the parking area and packed up his gun for the day. So that part kind of fit. Though, some of what Garth Snow had said in his statements didn't quite square away with his theory, and I'd needed to ask Bobby about it.
So here's the thing that confuses me, is that Garth Snow says that he was there, and there was one car in the parking lot, and it was a blue Ford Taurus with a white top.
Huh.
Did you see that car?
No.
Would you remember seeing that car?
The only car that was there was a March dark green Dodge. But when I went back out there, that dude's van was there.
Who's that dude?
the one that I talked to in the field.
How do you know it's his van?
I don't, because he'd have had to walk a long ways if he was walking there. And there was no one else there that I seen, so it had to have been his van.
When Bobby got back to the hunting area after finding the bodies, he'd seen a van there, and he'd assumed the van had belonged to Mr. Orange Hat. Because who else's van could it have been? And Garth Snow had been in a van that day. It was his work vehicle, and he'd driven it straight to the game area from a job he'd worked that morning. So the idea that Mr. Orange Hat is really Garth Snow really was a great theory. It just didn't hold up.
So, I asked you before about Garth Snow, and you didn't know that name. In your stories, I thought you were talking about Garth Snow because he kind of fits the role of the guy in the orange hat. But I showed you a picture, and you were pretty sure it was not him.
I've never seen them people before in my life.
The first time I met Bobby, I showed him a photo of Garth Snow. I thought for sure almost that he'd say, at the very least, that yeah, that could have been the guy in the orange hat. Instead, Bobby told me that he had no idea who the guy in the photo was, and whoever he was not Mr. Orange Hat. 30 years on, Bobby could easily be misremembering or misidentifying someone who he'd seen once fleetingly back in 1990, but in this case, there's good reason to think that Bobby's right and that it wasn't Garth Snow. Because the most identifying feature of Mr. Orange Hat is the fact that when Bobby had encountered him, he'd pointed a shotgun right in Mr. Orange Hat's face. That's the kind of encounter you're not likely to forget, especially when the police interview you about it shortly after. But none of Garth Snow's statements have ever mentioned Bobby pointing a gun at him, and when we spoke to Garth Snow, he was adamant. Bobby had never pointed a gun at him. No way, no how, didn't happen.
The remaining hunters from the initial police reports were all part of the same hunting party, a group of five friends from the town of Parchment, just north of Kalamazoo. They were all young, ranging in age from 20 to 22, and that afternoon had decided to go hunt the west side of Bear Creek. They parked at the parking area off of Y Avenue, on the other side of the game area, and spread out through the woods. One of the five hunters was Philip Dooley. His friends had told Susan he'd probably have a good memory of what had happened that night. And when Susan finally did get to talk to him, she found out they'd been right.
Did you hear shots all day, or did you hear any shots?
No, not really, no.
Do you recall hearing any shots but the two?
Man. No, actually, I mean, really, I don't, ma'am.
Like most other witnesses in the game area that day, Philip Dooley recalled only hearing two shots that afternoon, fired close together.
It was starting to get, not dark, but it was probably half hour before dark, I'd say, before when we heard the shots.
It was sometime after that, maybe 10, 20 minutes later, that the screaming had begun.
Because that's what I remember the most, is the kids screaming. We thought that someone was lost, and it was getting dark, and someone was scared. You could tell in the screams that he was scared.
Philip Dooley showed Susan on a map where he and his four friends had been positioned that day. Philip had actually been pretty far to the west, but one of his friends, Mark Lawrence, was right on the western edge of Bear Creek. Susan pointed out in the same map the spot where Doug Estes and Jim Bennett had been killed.
Yeah, so the murders were right... There's that.
Yeah, I knew they were close. Wow, Christ. Man, I can't believe how close one of them guys were.
Mark Lawrence had been on the other side of Bear Creek, maybe as little as a tenth of a mile away from where the shootings occurred. He was most likely the person who was closest to the crime scene at the time it happened, though we couldn't have seen anything across the creek.
At first, all I heard was help, 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 and I thought maybe it was one of my buddies, because like I said, there was a bunch of us out there.
Yeah.
And at first, maybe I thought I just need help dragging the deer, but then you could hear the scream, the voice, you could tell something was not right.
So you could tell it was like something really wrong.
Yes.
As close as Mark Lawrence was to Bobby, with the Bear Creek running in between them, he might as well have been miles away.
Well, I mean, like I said, I was close enough to hear the shots. And and to hear the boys screaming.
Yeah.
I mean, so I'm kind of glad that I didn't wander up onto it. And would the guy still been there? Yeah, I kind of am.
Did you try and get across the?
I tried going across the marsh and swamp and all that, but by the time I was covered in water.
It didn't sound like that was possible, really. Did
no, I had to turn around and come back.
Which means that even though there were a lot of hunters in the west side of the Fulton game area who were never contacted, maybe it was really safe to assume they weren't important to this case. Maybe they really can be ruled out as possible suspects. Because people who are familiar with Bear Creek all expressed deep skepticism that someone who committed the murders would have been able to cross over the creek as part of their escape route.
So it's a pretty messy, like, lot of brush.
Yeah, and I think it's even more messier. Right now it would be, it's mosquito infested. There's quicksand areas.
Okay, not going there.
Yeah, or stuff that, a bog-like substance that will.
Are you being serious?
I'm serious because you have to be careful.
That's Sid Paul. He lives in Fulton and knows the game area. Back in 1990, while trying to figure out whether Bear Creek really was an impassable barrier, the original detectives had gone to speak to him, and they'd learned that he'd often hunted the game area from a canoe. Sure, the detectives could have tried crossing over Bear Creek themselves, but on account of all the sinkholes and rattlesnakes, they decided to consult with a local expert instead.
It was a beautiful, high-resolution photograph, and they handed it to me upside down. Which made me kind of concerned at the beginning right there. Because they pointed out, you were over here, right? No. Turned it around. No, I was over here. And their question was, could someone get across from there, from that point?
From the east side to the west side?
It could, but it would take quite a bit. And it'd be pretty noisy for them to do it, splashing around.
And they'd be wet, you think? Definitely?
Definitely.
Okay. So no one's getting across dry?
Yes. Okay. Unless they were wearing big hip-high waders or chest-high waders.
Which means that, unless you happen to have special equipment with you, if you're on one side of Bear Creek and trying to cross over to the other, the only way to do so is to walk back to your car and drive there. Which is what the hunters from Parchment ended up doing.
We were trying to go to the person hollering and realized we couldn't get that way, so we came back out, met in the field, and decided to get in the car and drive around, see what was going on. By the time we got around, it was getting dark. I think it was pretty much dusk.
That's Bill Palmateer, one of the other hunters from the Parchment group. According to the police reports, Bill Palmateer and his four friends were the only hunters from the west side of Bear Creek who'd gone over to the east side when they'd heard the yelling. But that's not because those in the Parchment group were the only ones to have heard Bobby's yells. Other hunters had heard them too. Bill Palmateer is sure of that. It's just that the other hunters had a different response from the Parchment group.
I'm surprised more people didn't show up. I mean, and look, if y'all could hear them that well across the water.
Why were the people running? Why was the people, instead of, we were all kids going to help. Why were all these other adults running?
The way the other hunters had fled the scene sticks out in Philip Dooley's mind, too.
And we were asking, hey, is it, because the kid was still yelling. Mm-hmm. He's still yelling for help. And we're like, hey, have you guys lost anybody from your party? Because, somebody, nope. And, I mean, people just, they would come out, and we were like, and they would come out like here and just right down this line, because there was other cars all around.
When they returned to the parking area off of Y Avenue, there was only one other car remaining besides theirs. It was a dark Oldsmobile Cutlass, and it hadn't been there when they'd arrived, though there was no sign of who its driver might have been. The Parchment group split into two vehicles to drive out in search of whoever it was who'd been calling for help, and headed down Y Avenue and up 46 toward X Avenue, where it sounded like the cries for help had come from. It was the truck that Philip Dooley and Mark Lawrence were in that seems to have been the first to arrive at the little parking area off of X Avenue. As Philip Dooley remembers it, by the time they got there, an ambulance was already there on the scene.
We got out, and me and Mark were the first ones to, come up this way, right here. There was an old ambulance. There was two gentlemen standing there. And me and Mark walked up, and we were kind of making our way toward them, but not really to talk to them, but just kind of, Mm-hmm. And the guy goes, hey, man, he goes, you guys want to go see two dead bodies?
It was a strange question. You want to go see two bodies, the man had asked. But it wasn't just the question that was strange. The man's entire demeanor had seemed wrong to Philip Dooley.
He was just really excited about the way, just the way it came out of his mouth. I mean, hey, you guys want to go see two dead bodies?
In terms of his appearance, the thing about this man that stands out the most in Dooley's memory is the glasses the man was wearing.
The man had, what I remember it was, Stephen King glasses, okay? Stephen King always wore those real weird, distinctive, very distinctive glasses, okay?
So he's standing with the ambulance.
With another man, they were kind of, I'm pretty sure they both kind of like had their one foot up, you know, like something like this, standing against the ambulance.
Uh-huh.
You know, just chilling.
Was he an ambulance guy?
No, they weren't. No, they were just regular clothes, no like ambulance attendants or like people.
When Philip Dooley arrived at the parking area, the ambulance's actual attendants were nowhere to be seen. Presumably, they were already back in the woods with the bodies. But there were two men there, the man who I've been calling Stephen King, and also a second man. But Philip Dooley doesn't remember the second man so much, beyond his presence there. It's Stephen King who has been firmly etched into Philip's memory for all these years, because of how strange and uncomfortable his behavior had been. Philip Dooley's friend, Bill Palmateer, has a very similar memory. When the vehicle he was in pulled up at the parking area, Stephen King had been there to greet them, too.
So, did he come up to you? Who approached you?
He came up to us. We pulled up, and he kind of came out from where they had parked and was approaching us and was wanting to take us back there to see the dead bodies. And we thought about it first. We started to go back there, but changed our mind.
And did he seem, like, anxious or just curious? Like, what?
He just seemed, he really, really, really wanted us to see them bodies. He wanted us to go back there and see it, see what he had saw.
Philip Dooley remembers that when Stephen King had offered to go show them two dead bodies, the offer had been immediately rejected. But Bill Palmateer remembers that when he had spoken to the man, he'd at least momentarily considered it.
For some reason, he wanted us to go back and see him.
That's... And it wasn't like, let's go see if we can help them.
No, there's two dead people back there. Let's go check it out.
And at the time, or looking back, did you think that seemed weird, or...?
Yeah, it seemed weird at the time, but... Like I say, we were younger, so at first we were going to go, and then, yeah, really quickly realized it was a bad idea.
Yeah.
Mark Lawrence also remembers the man in the Stephen King glasses, though after all this time, his memory of the encounter has grown vaguer. Still, even now, the man's weirdness stands out.
So you remember that guy?
Yeah, I kind of sort of do, but like I said, it's been like 30 years.
Yeah, but I was wondering about him, because like no one's ever gotten his name.
Yeah.
And apparently he's been kind of weird about it, too.
Yeah. He didn't, you know, introduce himself. He always said, hey, you want to see some dead bodies?
Kind of like that. Not like, hey, want to go see if you can help, but like,
yeah.
Like actually just kind of like, let's go check out the bodies first.
Yeah, so that was kind of crazy.
It wasn't just Stephen King's demeanor that Philip Dooley found strange, though. The fact that there was an ambulance there at all when they'd pulled up had seemed surprising. He couldn't understand how there'd been enough time for any ambulance service to have reached the game area before then.
The thing is, how were they so, there so quick? I mean, I'm just saying. Because...
So quick? You think they were... Oh.
Well, they beat us there, and we were one street over.
How did they beat you there?
Hell, I don't know. Because...
You know, in the report... So in the report, it says that they were flagged over.
Oh, really? Yeah, guaranteed. I don't know who was flagged over. All I know is the man standing there in those glasses. I bet my soul that it was him. I mean, I'm telling you. I got that feeling. I really did.
Back in 1990, Philip Dooley had been immediately suspicious of Stephen King. And 30 years later, he's still suspicious of him. But even though Stephen King was acting kind of weird... Okay, extremely weird. I don't know if I'd make the jump to thinking it makes him necessarily the killer. But still, why exactly was he there? As far as Philip Dooley can recall, there was no sign the man had been there hunting.
Stephen King, like I said...
Did he have any orange on?
No. No.
No orange?
No, they're just plain clothes.
No, do you have a hat?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Unfortunately, beyond the Stephen King glasses, neither Bill Palmateer nor Philip Dooley can recall much else today about Stephen King's appearance. Bill thought the man was maybe in his mid-20s, and Phil puts him as older, in his late 30s, possibly. Most likely, though, both of them could have given a much more detailed description of the man back in 1990, when this all happened. Unfortunately, back in 1990, the police never asked them about this man and Stephen King glasses.
And you told the police about Stephen King.
Goddamn right,
in
1990. I did. Yeah, hell yeah, I did.
They didn't write it down.
Well, I know. And there then, at Bobby Palmateer's house, when the cold case detectives came and talked to all of us, I said, "Hey, listen, right off, you know, Jump Street, did anybody talk to a guy who looked like Stephen King or had glasses like Stephen King?"
The cold case team, unlike the original detectives, had at least written down Philip Dooley's statements about Stephen King when they'd interviewed him in 2001. It's all there in their reports. But there's no indication from the case file that anyone on the cold case team actually had any interest in the Stephen King figure. They made no effort to identify him and did not seem concerned that he might have any relevance to their case. When I told Philip Dooley that there'd never been any follow-up to the Stephen King thing, he hadn't seemed surprised. Even back at the time that he talked to them, he hadn't gotten the sense from the cold case team that they'd found the information he shared with them to be important.
Well, you know, I think they thought I was like a big joke when I was the Stephen King thing. I really do, ma'am. I think, you know, yeah. maybe I, you know, like red flagged myself or red flagged the situation by saying, you know, Stephen King.
It's possible that the cold case team's lack of interest in Stephen King had nothing to do with the moniker that Philip Dooley gave him, though. It's possible they had another reason for not wanting to pursue that line of investigation. Because at the time the cold case team interviewed Philip Dooley, they were almost done with their investigation. After nearly 2 years of work on the case, they were days away from finally arresting Jeff Titus. And at that point, I guess, why waste time investigating Stephen King? That gives us four unknown and still unidentified people who were at or near the crime scene on the day of the murders. There's Mr. Orange Hat, Stephen King, Kenny Rogers, and the Ditch Guy. But just because different people saw them doesn't mean that they're all different people. And I've wondered, how many unknown people exactly are we really dealing with here? Could two or more of them have been one and the same subject? Maybe. Though Kenny Rogers is the outlier in the group. He's older, portly, with a beard, no glasses than Mark Perry could recall. He's probably his own person. But the other three, well, they're harder to distinguish. All three wore glasses, as far as the witnesses recall now, and two of them, Ditch Guy and Stephen King, seem to have been wearing the exact same style of glasses, too, the metal-rimmed aviators. But based on the timing of their appearances, it seems like Ditch Guy and Stephen King may have just had similar styles when it comes to eyewear. Because Ditch Guy had driven off the road and into that ditch sometime around 5 p.m. that day, and by about 5:15 or so, the truck had pulled him out of the ditch and Ditch Guy had been on his way, last seen heading south.
At the time that Ditch Guy was seen in the ditch, though, the Parchment Group hadn't even arrived at the parking lot off of X Avenue yet. Although it's not exactly clear when they got there, it was already turning dark when they'd pulled up, so it had to have been after sunset. And that would mean the encounter with Stephen King couldn't have happened any sooner than 5:18 p.m. at the very earliest, and it was probably closer to around 5:40 p.m. or so. So Ditch Guy should have been long gone by the time the Parchment Group first saw Stephen King. Unless, of course, Ditch Guy had doubled back for some reason. Which maybe he could have done. There's nothing to say he didn't, anyway. And then there's Mr. Orange Hat. He had glasses, too, from what Bobby remembers. But Stephen King wasn't wearing orange at all, so Mr. Orange Hat can't be him. Unless, of course, he'd removed his hat at some point before the Parchment Group got there. Which, again, he could have. And if he had, well, maybe it could have been him standing there in the parking area, leaning up against the ambulance. The timing kind of fits anyway, but far from conclusive. Here's at least one small thing we can be sure of anyway. Stephen King was definitely not Bobby Brown, because both Bill Palmateer and Philip Dooley have separate memories of seeing Bobby there at the parking area, in addition to also seeing Stephen King, and both describe Bobby as being younger and far more agitated than Stephen King was.
And when you get there, who was present at the parking lot off of X?
Some guy, mid-20s maybe. Never got his name, don't know who he was.
And so there was a kid, which presumably is Bobby, the stepson.
The son-in-law.
And he's walking around, freaking out.
Yeah. He's pacing up and down the road with his gun.
So he's like on the main X Avenue area.
Yeah.
And no one tries to take the gun away, or?
Not even after the cops got there. He still continued to walk up and down the road.
That's what your brother said. I'm like, that's crazy. They just... I mean,
You have no idea who did this. Like, just take all the weapons away.
All of them. We offered them ours. And they didn't want nothing to do with them.
Even though the police were unconcerned by Bobby pacing around with a shotgun, the group from Parchment hadn't been feeling nearly so comfortable with the situation. Phil Dooley even made an attempt to get Bobby's shotgun away from him.
The thing was, we were trying to get the gun out of the son-in-law's hand. I mean, he was, you know, in hysterics. And, you know, I'm like, dude, somebody get his gun, man. I mean, you know, Christ, you know, you don't know what state of mind he's in.
What was he doing? When did you first see him?
Not long after, you know, we come up and he just come marching out, you know, out from back, you know, just in a frantic, you know. Oh, my God, you know, just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And he kept talking about a cigarette. So I kind of, like, chased him down, you know, because I smoked. And I go, here, man, you know, have a cigarette. I go, hey, bro, why don't you, you know, set that gun down somewhere, you know.
Philip Dooley was unsuccessful in convincing Bobby to put his shotgun down. And this is actually something that Bobby remembers as well.
When you get to the parking lot, is anyone there?
Yeah, there was a bunch of people there. So they was telling me that I should give them my gun. Or give it to the police, or I don't remember. They was probably scared to take it from me, I don't know.
Yeah, a lot of people mentioned that. They saw you pacing back and forth with the shotgun.
What was I supposed to do with it? Throw it down? That's my dad's. It wasn't even my gun.
So Stephen King was not Bobby Brown. And Stephen King wasn't Garth Snow either. Because Phil Dooley remembered seeing Garth Snow there too. He even recalled Snow's last name. So the Orange Hat Man isn't him. And the police never tried to interview Stephen King, because as best as anyone can remember, he was gone by the time the police finally did show up. But he hadn't left immediately after the Parchment group arrived. He'd been there for a while, in the parking area. And although the police had been slow to arrive at the scene that night, there were others who had been much quicker.
News 3, I believe, showed up first because we were standing there talking to them. And someone said something about the newspaper was pulling up, and they were like, hey, don't tell those guys anything.
Someone from the Kalamazoo Gazette was there, as was someone from Channel 3. And Channel 3 got video footage, something which almost caused Philip Dooley to get in trouble, because that day he called into work sick in order to go out hunting with his friends.
It's a day that kind of, you know, it kind of stuck in my head because, you know, I called at work that morning because I work days, and I'm on the 6 o'clock news, standing there in my pumpkin suit, you know. Oh, yeah, you look real sick, Dooley.
From what Bill Palmateer remembers, the news segment on the murders at the Fulton State game area had included footage of lots of people who were gathered there at the parking area.
But in the video, you can see all of us standing together.
What video?
They've showed the video on TV of that.
Channel 3
news had
a video.
I don't
think I have it anymore.
They actually showed quite a bit. They showed the kid. Yeah, they seemed like they showed quite a few people standing out there. But it was all before the cops showed up.
So the news was there before the cops?
Oh, yeah. There was a ton of people there before the cops ever showed up. It was a goat rodeo.
So far, all efforts to turn up a copy of this video have failed. Channel 3 doesn't have it in their archives, and no other source that we've checked with has been able to turn it up either. But I refuse to believe that this news footage is really gone forever. Or, at the very least, that there isn't a copy on VHS somewhere out there tucked away in someone's attic. So maybe, one day or another, it'll show up. And if it does, maybe we'll finally be able to see Stephen King's face.
The video showed all of us. Showed all of us. It actually showed the son, or the stepson.
And this guy's probably hanging around in the background.
He's probably there.
I mean, that would be pretty conclusive if someone's there who shouldn't be there at all.
Yeah, I guess you're right. He never really did give us a reason why he was there. He never said that he was even there hunting. He just said, I found these bodies. Come check it out.
Did he say, I found them?
Yeah. He said, I found these bodies. Come check it out.
So I'm still holding out hope for the Channel 3 video. After all, it wouldn't be the first time in this case that important evidence had gone missing, only to turn up again. Like when Jeff Titus called to say that he'd found Doug Estes's missing shotgun. Next time, on Undisclosed. That's all for episode 3 of the new season of Undisclosed, covering the case of Jeff Titus. We're back next Monday with episode 4, and don't forget to send us your questions for the addendum episode this Thursday. Methil Telhan is our executive producer. Our logo is designed by Baluki, and our theme music by Ramiro Marquez. Audio production is by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media, host of the Crime Blenders On podcast. and music for this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions. Transcripts for this episode will be available at our website at undisclosed-podcast.com, prepared by our amazing transcript team, Britta Bliss, Erica Fladell, Don Locus, and Skylar Park. And of course, thank you to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. You can follow us online, on all social media. Our handle is @UndisclosedPod. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners out there have information on Jeff Titus's case they'd like to share with us, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com, or you can call and leave a message at 410-205-5563. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.